Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection between food and grief, with your hosts, Sara Tangora
and Bobby Conforto.
On this show, we're going to really explore where grief and food intersect, how they go hand in hand, different people's experiences with their specific traumas and how food played a part from the beginning to the end of that experience.
And how as individuals, we uniquely process life's traumas and losses through either the longing for, the creating of, the avoiding of, the obsessing over, and the eating of food.
I remember right after Michael died, I still miss him, but I missed him so badly that night that I stopped at the convenience store on the corner and I bought a container of Ben & Jerry's Cherry Garcia. It's too sweet, you know, it's too everything. And I went home with it and I took it to bed and I thought to myself, gee, so this is my first ménage à trois after Michael's death. Me, Ben, and Jerry. And I ate the entire thing.
What do you think your relationship to food was during times of crisis?
I think that my sister and I use food to reward ourselves.
I wish I had something more interesting to say, but definitely like spaghetti and meatballs and chocolate cake.
My mom still can't eat Rugula. It makes her too sad. I've also experienced a lot of loss, as has Bobby. And I think we really wanted to find a way where we could like work together. There's something that feels very compelling about doing a project with you, Mom, as just kind of a missing piece in life and just something we've always wanted to do but not known quite how.
Can't think of anything better myself.
I think that, I mean, any conversation about grief, I think, prepares everyone for grief because there are so few conversations about grief. It's why I think that what you guys are doing is so important.
This episode is brought to you by Fair Kitchens. Learn about the Fair Kitchens Code and join the movement at fairkitchens.com.
Hi, and welcome to Why Food Podcast, the podcast about career changers, entrepreneurs, and innovators. I'm your host, Valerie Lomas, and our co-host, Ethan Frisch, is not with us. He's actually still in Armenia right now, sourcing spices for his company, and you can follow along at Burlap and Barrel, although I'm pretty sure this will be airing when he is back stateside. So thank you so much for joining us this week. We have Alex here, who is the Director of Sales at Frida's Produce. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Okay, so, you know, your journey into food, it's a little different than most people because you really did truly grow up around food because your grandmother started a produce distribution company, which your mother then, or at the time, was a part of. So you weren't just literally always at trade shows and always involved in the food industry. At what point was it, did you realize that that was a path that you wanted to go down yourself?
So I grew up in the family business working every summer, every spring and winter break, but it wasn't until halfway through college that I realized that the produce industry is a really special industry, and selling fruits and vegetables to consumers all over the country is a privilege. And, you know, everyone wants to eat more fruits and vegetables and knows they should eat more fruits and vegetables. And I think being a part of that, I realized, was something really cool and special. So about halfway through college, I decided I definitely wanted to be in produce. And then my senior year in college, after I worked for a different family business in the produce industry, I realized that working with your family is something really unique, especially if it's a business that interests you. I think a lot of people who have a family business, it's flooring or plumbing or something that they're like, I'm not really into it, but I feel an obligation. And I'm lucky that I got to work in my family's business that, you know, is women owned and women run and sells really cool products and is just a fun environment. So I'm really lucky.
I mean, I think it's really cool that you said produce is really special. And you mentioned because it's something that we consume and we feel good about consuming because we know it's good for us. It's nourishing. It's something we can share with other people. What else is special about this industry?
So what's really cool about the produce industry is, of course, it's a global industry. And in the U.S., there's, you know, a lot of our produce is grown in the U.S., which is really cool. And it's a lot of family businesses. And a lot of the produce companies that you see in your grocery store today, like Chiquita or Dole or Taylor Farms or Nature Sweet or Driscoll's, at some point were started by a family or represents family businesses, you know, of different growers around the world. So I think knowing that there's a lot of family in produce, and even if a company's not run by the family anymore, they still have a lot of those values that the family held. And so a lot of different produce companies really feel like family businesses. When you go work there, go even visit, you feel like everyone there is family. So that's really what I love about the industry.
Right. And I mean, so your grandmother started this company back in the 60s, mm-hmm. right? And you said she was 40 years old when she started this. So this was almost like her own second career of sorts. I mean, there's such a beautiful origin story with this business. Could you give us just kind of like a brief overview of first of all, why did your grandmother at 40 years old decide to start a business? And how was it that the business got off the ground?
So my grandmother, when she had my mom, she was in her late 30s, and she wanted to be home to breastfeed her. So she needed a job with odd hours, and the LA wholesale produce market opens at 2 a.m. and closes at 10 a.m. And she had an aunt and an uncle who worked at a produce company on the LA market. So she's like, hey, do you have a job? And they hired her to do accounting. And they went on vacation one week, and they're like, hey, you need to run the sales floor for us. So she ran the sales floor and she excelled. She did such a great job. There's a fun story to that in and of itself. And when they got back from vacation, they're like, you're never going back upstairs to accounting. You're staying right here on the sales floor. And she did so well for herself the next few years that the owners of the LA wholesale produce market had an open stall, and they approached her and said, hey, we think you should go into business for yourself. You're super successful. You're really smart. We think you'd do well. And she's like, okay, why not? You know, she saw no obstacles. She never thought, I mean, she said, I've never been in, you know, I've never owned a business before. I don't know what I'm doing, but they were willing to help her, and she got a loan from the bank, and she was really able to kind of hit the ground running and didn't have any fears or nothing blocked her from doing it. So that's really how she got started, a very practical reason. And then it excelled from there because she was the only woman on the LA wholesale produce market that wasn't a secretary or accountant. And so she was known for being super open-minded. She was known for having specialty products that back then were exotic, like brown mushrooms. So people always went to her when there was something new and different because no one else knew how to sell it.
Right. So, I mean, I heard this great story. First of all, she was the first woman-owned produce distribution business in this country, right?
Yes.
Which is pretty phenomenal. But I heard this wonderful story about how someone was looking for Chinese gooseberries. And, you know, they were asking around and, you know, people were like, no, we don't have that. And they weren't all that interested in necessarily helping this person find them. Mm-hmm. But your grandmother was.
Yes.
And can you just kind of briefly sum up that story? Because I loved hearing it. Because when I heard it, I was thinking, what the heck are Chinese gooseberries? And I think our listeners are probably wondering what those are too. But your grandmother helped put like a major fruit in our grocery stores that we now enjoy like it's always been there.
Mm-hmm. So again, Frida started with brown mushrooms, which were exotic back then. And one day she had a customer, a grocery store, come up to her and say, I have a shopper looking for Chinese gooseberries. She's like, don't know what those are, but when I find them, I will call you. And a few months later, there was a broker, someone who helps a grower sell their produce, walking up and down the LA wholesale produce market saying, I have these Chinese gooseberries from New Zealand. And no one knew what they were. They were brown and fuzzy on the outside and green on the inside, and no one had heard of them. So they're like, I can't help you, but go to Frida. So this guy goes to Frida and she's like, I will take them. I have a customer. Calls the customer, gets him his Chinese gooseberries. And we joke that that's when we learned the shelf life of Chinese gooseberries, because it took her almost 4 months to sell the first pallet of Chinese gooseberries. And in that time when she was selling them, there were, you know, different people who knew of Chinese gooseberries kind of talking about it. And they realized, you know, this name's not resonating with shoppers. I mean, before the Chinese gooseberry, the last fruit people were introduced to for the first time was bananas. So it had been a long time.
When did bananas come on the scene? Because, I mean, obviously, you know, we're of a certain generation where, you know, bananas have just been a part of our existence. I know I put bananas on my Cheerios growing up. They've just always been here.
Yeah, I think it was in the 1800s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it had been a really long time.
So, like, at least 60 years before we had been introduced with, like, a new produce. Okay.
And so they had been talking about, what can we name it? And I think because they were native to New Zealand, and we joked that they're both brown and fuzzy and don't fly, they decided to change the name to kiwi. So that is now how we have the kiwi fruit. And I think people were, I know people who think, yeah, when it was the 80s when I first saw kiwi fruit. Mm. That's because it took 18 years from when she first brought it into the U.S. to it becoming an everyday item. And we joke that it was the 18-year overnight success story, because people think that it kind of just happened immediately, and it really did take a long time. And now, I don't know any business person who would invest 18 years to get a product off the ground, but that's what she did. And so, and changing the name, I think, definitely helped. But since then, our company's introduced over 200 products to the US supermarket. So before my grandma and my mom and my aunt, there was no habanero chilies, jicama, shallots, sugar snap peas, seedless watermelon, spaghetti squash. I could go on and on.
Right. And these are things that I think of staples. I have some sugar snap peas in my refrigerator right now. But a lot of these fruits, I mean, I like to travel. I've discovered them when I was traveling, and it's so nice to be able to come home and find them. Mm-hmm. Like, I went to Thailand maybe 4 years ago, and I experienced dragon fruit for the first time. And then, you know, I come back here, and all of a sudden I see dragon fruit ending up in people's smoothie bowls on Instagram, because if nothing else, they are photogenic. Mm-hmm. They, like, the camera loves them, the little seeds, it picks up on that. And, you know, I'm not going to say it's met that 18-year mark of being completely commonplace, but they're also called pitaya,
yes,
right? But people definitely are buying pitaya smoothie bowls, mm-hmm, whether or not they even know what a dragon fruit looks
exactly.
like.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think, you know, another funny story is turmeric. You know, I think it's probably been 5 years now since National Geographic put turmeric in their issue saying it's a natural food, like a natural food health remedy. And we had been selling turmeric for 20 years before then. And all of a sudden it blew up, and now it's a $1 million item for our company. And it takes time for people to embrace an item. And I think as they travel, media now, Instagram alone brings produce to people. And so we at Frida's are fortunate to have all of that awesome food media, even podcasts like this to bring new products to consumers. So I think it's, you know, from the distribution side, it's a lot of patience and educating the consumer on how they can use it every day. And I think, like you were saying, with dragon fruit, it's not an everyday item yet, but we're getting pretty close to where consumers are going to go to the grocery store and expect to see dragon fruit every day in every store, just like a pineapple or a mango. So we're getting close.
I mean, I for one will be happy when we get to that day, because as someone who spent at least a year making smoothie bowls, I remember, like, running around New York City looking for dragon fruit, and I'd often end up in Chinatown where I could find it. But sometimes it was at the grocery stores, but oftentimes it wasn't. But that was like a whole two or three years ago. So I'm sure things have changed. Mm-hmm. But so I love that, you know, your grandmother was willing to take on this product, these Chinese gooseberries, or even willing to listen to this, to someone who was looking for them, when the other people at the LA market weren't willing to do that. And I think that in a way kind of speaks to, I mean, I for one think women, we have to be a little bit more innovative. We have to find a way to kind of stand out and separate ourselves, because the odds are often stacked against us. Mm-hmm. So I love that she kind of used that opportunity and really put her business on the map, so much so that it's still, you know, going strong today. Mm-hmm. And it's so fascinating that it's really been passed down through the women in your family. Mm-hmm. You know, your mother, your aunt, and now you, her granddaughter, mm-hmm. are kind of carrying the torch. But do you see any obstacles, or do you face obstacles today that you think you might be getting them more because you're a woman, especially as a director of sales? Mm-hmm. And if so, like, what do you do to kind of combat those?
I mean, it's interesting, especially, you know, after the Me Too movement, I really realized how fortunate I was, because I grew up in a family where the women worked and the women were successful. And I am so grateful I never thought, like, women don't own businesses, or like, wow, a woman business owner, this is amazing. Because to me, that was my norm. And once I realized that that's not the norm, I became extremely grateful and humbled by that. And I also, you know, of course, never experienced any like sexual harassment at work. Like, I think we were one of the few businesses, women owned long term, that our company culture has been pretty amazing throughout our 57 years in business. And so I've never at my workplace have felt like, because I was a woman, especially a young woman, and I've moved up pretty quickly just on my own. I've worked really hard to get to where I am in the family business. And so that's been great. I feel very fortunate. However, in the produce industry, there's more women now than ever before, but it's still somewhat male dominated. And there's a few companies out there who are pretty old school, where there's the good old boys club. And I don't think I'm not taken as seriously as a director of sales, because I'm a 30-year-old woman and, you know, my mom's the president. Like, mm-hmm. everyone still sees me as Karen's daughter and Frida's granddaughter, because, I mean, I was going to trade shows in our industry since I was in a stroller.
So they know you.
They know me. And if I say Frida's and they see me, they're like, oh, are you Karen's daughter? Which is great. I love it. So I think I'm still working on making sure people take me seriously as an individual, not as a relative of someone, or, oh, she's just like this young woman, she doesn't know, you know,
right,
nearly as much as I do. So yeah, I still think there's room for growth in our industry, especially, and in the retail industry, I would say. However, we're making a lot of progress, and I think people are very aware of kind of the old ways of, you know, certain types of company cultures, but it's changing, and the women are speaking louder and louder in our industry, which is really cool. And we have a lot of men who are super supportive. So it's
allies.
Exciting.
We need yes. you allies.
We love it.
This episode is brought to you by Fair Kitchens. The food service industry faces a challenge. More people are eating out, yet restaurants are losing talent. Why is this? Research by Fair Kitchens reveals a serious well-being issue within professional kitchens. 74% of chefs are sleep deprived to the point of exhaustion. 63% of chefs feel depressed, and more than half feel pushed to the breaking point. This can't be ignored. Fair Kitchens is a movement based on the belief that a positive kitchen culture makes for a healthier business. By taking the pledge to be a Fair Kitchen, they'll provide you with free information, tools, and resources to help you take action towards making your restaurant more stable, productive, and happy, which positively affects the guest experience. It's time to act now. Learn about the Fair Kitchens Code and join the movement at fairkitchens.com.
more about like your personal journey. So you've been with the company for 8.5 years, and you've kind of, you know, but you've really been at the company longer because, as you mentioned, you've been going with the company president to trade shows ever, probably since you were a very young child, and your first, you know, internships working were at the company, whether it was, you know, just filing papers, but you've kind of like maybe learned a lot just by being in it, right? But, you know, obviously you did have that moment where you decided this was what you wanted to do, but let's just back up a little bit before that. So, you know, when you went to college, when you started college, you weren't so sure, and you ended up majoring in communications and PR. Can you just tell me a little bit about your personal journey and how you've kind of spent those 8.5 years working your way up through the company and what you've learned along the way?
What was really cool was, I mean, my family's business has never been that family business where if you're family, you have a job. You have to apply, you have to interview, you have to be qualified. And I was really fortunate that, you know, a job opening came up at Frieda's for communications. So I was able to really use my degree and PR especially. I mean, I started in 2011 when bloggers were like kind of new and still like all the rage as far as like the only kind of consumer influencer outlet before Instagram was a food scene and everything like that. So I started out there, and I thought I was going to just work there for a little bit. I wanted to move to Australia. I interned there the year before at a produce family business, and I loved it. And so I wanted to move to Australia, but then I met my husband, so I wasn't going anywhere. But my journey at Frieda's has been really special because I started in marketing, and marketing is where you get to tell the story and you get to talk about the food and the growers and how to use it and talk to consumers, talk to influencers, talk to people in the industry, the trade publications. And I loved that because I really developed my product knowledge there and a love for the food, not just, you know, the industry or my customers or anything like that. And then typical family business situation, my mom literally over a weekend threw me into sales, which is terrifying because selling something that's perishable is really hard. I mean, it's not something, it's there and it's ready to go. It is not something that you get to press a button and manufacture. So
And everything isn't a kiwi that's gonna hang out for months.
Exactly.
Just okay, right?
Exactly. So I felt the pressure, but I've loved it. And so I moved into sales over 5 years ago and excelled. And it's a, you know, it's a people business, and it's all about relationships, and you have to love produce to be successful in it because it's a tough business. I mean, I'm sure everyone listening knows about droughts in California and labor issues and immigration. I mean, we rely on immigrants to come into this country and pick all our produce. And so it's tough. And, but we love it, and we're going to do anything we can to progress the industry forward. So I feel really fortunate to work not only in my family's business, but in the produce industry.
Yeah. So I'm curious, though, because, you know, we had a chance to chat before, and you mentioned some podcasts that you listen to. Like, what keeps you motivated? What keeps you wanting to continue to bring this business into, you know, the present and the future? And maybe you can name some of those podcasts for our listeners, if, you know, because maybe they'll benefit from them also.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's tough to be in a family business because if you're there just to continue the family legacy, that's not going to be enough because if it, you know, yes, it's nice to carry the legacy on, but you have to be passionate and you have to grow with the times and be innovative. And so I'm lucky we have a team that really keeps us on our toes and keeps us moving forward. And what also keeps me motivated is, you know, knowing that there are so many people out there who have started businesses later in life, including my grandmother, and they were successful, but they failed along the way. They made mistakes. They made expensive mistakes. They've made people mistakes, which are some of the hardest mistakes to make, but they get through it because they're passionate about what they do. They care about the people that work for them, and they believe in their product or their business model. So for me, you know, I've really, in my adult life post-college, I've only worked at Frida's. And of course, yes, I wish I worked somewhere else before, but, you know, I try and listen, I read, I go to conferences, professional development conferences, and I listen to a lot of business podcasts. And the two that have been super helpful for me to kind of in times keep my head up when I'm like, how has my mom done this for 45 years? One of them is called Second Life. And it follows women, it has women tell their stories who are encountering their second life of their career. And most of them have started a business, usually a shift from what they were originally doing. And then the second podcast is How I Built This. And it's a really well-known podcast, I believe through NPR. And it tells the stories of entrepreneurs for some of the biggest companies that people know today, like Sprinkles Cupcakes or Patagonia or Spanx or Kind Bars. I mean, everyone. And what's really cool is a lot of these people were in the middle of a career and they got an idea. And so it's interesting to kind of hear how they fail and how they succeed and what it takes to keep on going.
Yeah. And I mean, I love what you said about passion. Because I think that's really a commonality in the food industry specifically, and probably a lot of other creative industries as well. But, you know, whether it's distributing produce or working in media or, you know, being a content creator, I think passion is that necessary ingredient that's going to keep you excited to get up in the morning and excited to not just do what you did the day before, but think about, like, how can I do this better? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I definitely think that's huge. And I also love how you mentioned, you know, you are constantly trying to improve yourself, whether that's going to conferences. And your company is actually out of Southern California where you live, and you're in New York this week for a trade show, mm-hmm. right? And you know, I think that's just like another really invaluable tool. And it's interesting because often it costs money. It costs money to go to conferences. It takes up your time. Mm-hmm. Some of the like fees are pricey, and especially if you're just starting out. But it can be invaluable in making those connections, like you mm-hmm. talked about, people.
Exactly. And what's cool is I know in the produce industry, I know friends who have either gotten laid off or wanted to make a career change and, you know, maybe couldn't afford to go to the biggest trade show of the year. And they reach out to the organization and they say, hey, do you have any extra passes that maybe you were comping for the press or for, you know, did someone who has a booth not use their one badge? Or do you know anyone who may have extra badges to get into a trade show so that I can network? And I find that most of the time they say yes and they help you because they want you to be successful on your own. And they are invaluable. I mean, the network, especially, I mean, I'm sure everyone says this, but in produce, it's all about who you know. And I think today, you know, people are prideful. They don't want to get a job just because they knew someone. They want to get a job because they earned it, because they're qualified. But I mean, anyone has access to any job posting with the internet, and you know, you're going to be one in 1,000 if you just go off a job posting versus making a connection with someone at that company. And I have a person that I kind of mentor, and she interned for us like 3 or 4 years ago. She reached out to me this summer. She's like, I'm going to be in LA. I would love to get lunch with you. And we got lunch, and she was telling me how much she loves Frida's. She loved her time at our company, and she sees herself in the future working at Frida's again. And she put herself out there. She's like, look, I don't know if you have job openings now. You probably don't. I know at some point I want to have a career at Frida's. I love your brand. I love your company. I want to help bring fresh food to people and increase consumption. And I just want you to know that. And I think I was not expecting it. And she put herself out there, and now, whenever there's a position open that I think would be a good even entryway for her, she's going to be the first one I think of. And another thing, too, is let's say you want to be in sales at Frida's, for example. Your pathway may not be exactly starting with a sales position. It could be in another department. So I think at any company that people want to work at, or if they want to, you know, start to build something by working somewhere else, take any job you can, because once you're in, you have access to everyone there. And so I think it's important to not be too prideful and to take that entry-level job in a different department just to get your foot in the door.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's really great advice because, you know, we're in an age right now where I think people are being more conscious, maybe not than ever, but we're all being very conscious about what it is that we consume, what it is that we put into our bodies. And people are very excited about that. And I think there are a lot of people who are wondering, like, how can I do more? How can I be a part of this? How can I make this a career? Mm-hmm. And I think that's excellent advice, like getting your foot in the door. And I know it's really tough, but you know, if you're in a position where you can volunteer your time and just learn what's happening. And that was really excellent advice you said about if you recognize a conference or a trade show where you know if you can get yourself in that room and get FaceTime with people, like that's going to unlock a lot of opportunities. If you can't pay the registration, just send an email and ask. Mm-hmm. Like you said, like people actually want to help, especially people who are just getting started, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, I feel like the more we're all successful, the more we're all successful.
Exactly. yeah, and in produce, I think, too, it's, you know, we're always, it's, again, it's a family, it's really a family business industry, and we're constantly trying new ways to get younger people, or not even younger, but, like, new people into the industry. So, like, I just hired a guy who came from beverages. He was, you know, representing a brand that I think Pepsi would sell, which is great. And he's like, look, I want to make a shift. I want to get into the produce industry. I don't have produce experience, but I know how to sell. And I'm passionate because, you know, I think his wife had breast cancer and they changed the way they ate. And he started cooking more and he realized, like, this isn't just about our health. It's a lifestyle. And I want to be a part of making that people's lifestyle too, is more fruits and vegetables. And so the produce industry is a very welcoming community for sure. And I think there's not enough people who ask for help or ask, like, how can I get involved? And so when you ask, it's really impactful and you stand out and you will definitely get help. So
yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's December and we're in New York City. Where, I mean, if I go to the grocery store, I'm sometimes looking around like, I don't want to buy those blueberries because I know they won't taste like anything. Mm-hmm. What are, like, some of your favorite winter produce that that you're really excited about, that the company is really excited about, mm-hmm. Especially with you being in California, which is, like, a completely different climate and different array of options that you have access to?
Yes. So, believe it or not, winter time is citrus time. And I think a lot of people think of citrus as a fruit and it's sweet and sour and bright and refreshing. So they think maybe more warm weather months. But citrus grown in the U.S., mostly out of California, it's winter time. So we're entering the peak of season right now. And the peak really goes through March, maybe even April on some varieties. So we have quite a few months ahead of us of some great citrus items. At Frida's, our top ones are Meyer lemons, mm-hmm. which are that sweet lemon.
Perfect for baking. Perfect for all of your baking needs.
Exactly.
Ooh, that's like the best.
It's so good. It's so fragrant. We have pink lemons, which are a little bit pink on the outside and pink on the inside. Same flavor, just a cool color. We have seedless lemons, which make cooking a lot easier. Kumquats, obviously, it's a very big California item. Most people who grew up in California grew up with a kumquat tree on their street or in their backyard. And then we kind of get into some interesting varietals. So we have Buddha's hand, which if you Google it, it literally looks like a hand with 10, 15 fingers, and it's a citrus fruit, and it doesn't have any flesh, but it's very fragrant, and it's all rind and pith, which is that white stuff in between the skin and the flesh of like an orange. So Buddha's hand's available right now and will be available through February, and we have an item that I think is going to continue to trend that's in season now is calamondin or calamansi. It's popular in Filipino cuisine, used for tenderizing meats and different marinades and sauces. So we sell calamondin.
What's
so that's
the
available.
Flavor on that? Is it tart and sour?
It's a little tart and sour. sometimes a little sweet. It's really not meant to be eaten whole, but you can. I mean, kids love it. Kids love any citrus fruit. Like, I mean, everyone loves giving their baby a lemon for the first time, right? So you can have that experience with so many different citrus fruits. So calamondin looks like a really tiny clementine that you can eat whole, but really mix it in for different sauces and marinades. So citrusy season is big. And then, of course, right now, as it's still cold, our Stokes purple sweet potatoes are super popular. So
I just want to say I love them. I've had them. I've tried them. I made a purple sweet potato pie with them.
Awesome.
And I served it like at a party. I had people over and I actually added coconut milk, which was like nice to kind of play up on this. Like, it's a little bit more like island. I felt very islandy. Totally. Right? So I am a fan of these.
Good. That's awesome.
So they're like really popular.
Though. Yeah. We were the first. I mean, it's the first purple skin, purple flesh sweet potato that the U.S. has seen. People maybe think, oh, that's ube, which is a purple skin, purple flesh potato variety. But you can't get that fresh in the U.S. And then there's also Okinawan sweet potatoes, which are white skin with purple flesh. Very starchy, also hard to get. So the Stokes purple sweet potatoes, California grown, available all over the country. And it's not too sweet. And that's what I love about it, because I love savory foods. I'm not a sweet, I love, you know, dessert I'm down for, but I don't crave sweets. I crave salty and acidic and crunchy. And purple sweet potatoes allow you to have savory preparations without it being too sweet. And then it's this bright, beautiful purple color. So right now, baking it into pies, or just roasting it, or serving them whole with, you know, whatever your favorite sauce is great. And then as everyone enters into healthy eating for January and all those New Year's resolutions, purple sweet potatoes are perfect. It has a low glycemic index. So for diabetics, it's really good. And then also for people who are athletes and bodybuilders, it's a perfect item that, you know, slowly, the sugar slowly released. So it appeals to all palates.
I love it. So I want to talk just a little bit before we close about the future of not just produce, but of our ability to grow produce. I mean, especially you're in California, and it seems like every time I turn on the news, there's something happening, whether it's wildfires, which, you know, are a huge thing that's happening, or, you know, mudslides. There's something happening in California, and I lived there for 7 years, and, you know, we're at a time where I wonder, like, is this going to affect our ability for things to grow? Like, where do you, as someone who's really in the industry with your hand on the pulse, mm-hmm. where do you see the future going, and what can we do to kind of maybe help keep things on track?
So specifically with California in mind, and it's cool, we have a conference every year in the produce industry called the Washington Conference every September, where people can go to DC and lobby on the Hill on behalf of the produce industry. And I've gone every year, probably the last 9 or 10 years, because I went to school right outside DC. So I'd meet my mom at this conference, and the issues have stayed the same the last 20 years in California, at least, and in the produce industry, which is labor, having a comprehensive immigration reform so that we can have consistent labor available to us. Because I think people forget that the only way you have food in your grocery store is because of the immigrants coming into our country and picking it.
And it's not easy work.
No, I mean, you know, we were talking earlier, picking berries, you have to bend over or squat down close to the ground in usually hot sun, because during the summer it's a great crop, and hand pick every single berry. Lettuce, people are bending over and cutting lettuce all day. And I mean, I watch them and my back hurts looking at it. And so, you know, but they work hard, work hard to make money to send back to their families.
And we all are enjoying literally the fruits of that labor. Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, voting for comprehensive immigration reform to make sure we can get immigrants into our country legally but easily is really important. Another one that we can't help is, you know, what Mother Nature does to the weather in California, especially with droughts. if we don't have enough rain or snowpack in the winter, it's really tough to have enough water to nourish the crops. And there's been articles out there that in 20 years, who knows what California will be able to grow in a massive way that we can ship all over the country. I think people don't realize that it's the salad bowl of the United States. Your lettuce, all your greens that you're getting are either from California or Arizona. And if California has a drought, that takes out 6 months of produce that you're not going to be able to get. And so labor, water, those are the biggest issues. And then, of course, you know, truck drivers. These days is like, I want to grow up to be a truck driver. Mm-hmm. It's really good money, but you're away from your family. And so I think it comes down to these tactical things that have nothing to do with the actual produce itself. But that's why it's important for people to really be involved politically, to read up and research and look at where their food comes from. And our industry has a great movement for bringing salad bars into schools all over the country. And what that's done is increased awareness of fresh produce to children, especially in communities where they don't maybe have the money to buy fresh produce every week, and they're getting salad for free every day at school. And they're wanting to go to the grocery store with their parents and buy fresh produce. Now it's about teaching them where their produce comes from, so that way they can understand kind of the food chain. So I think that's what we can do to help the future of produce. And it's also just having an understanding that the less labor and water we have, the more expensive it's going to be to get produce to consumers. So you're going to see prices go up. Retailers do a great job of trying to keep those prices down, but inevitably prices will go up. So it's understanding that that's just your cost of produce is the cost of growing it and harvesting it and shipping it. So, you know, it's tough, but people will always need to eat. People want to eat more fruits and vegetables. You know, there's more coming. We're importing from all over the world because the world has so much to offer. And the United States grows a ton of produce here, and everyone's really wanting more local produce. So I don't think we're going to have a shortage of produce in general, but I think it will get tougher in the U.S. for growers to be profitable and make a living and feed their families by growing produce as we continue to encounter these issues.
Right. And we want to keep these wonderful, healthy, nourishing foods accessible mm-hmm. to everyone. Essentially, everyone should be able to have access mm-hmm. to fresh fruits and vegetables, and the price shouldn't be prohibitive to anyone. So I exactly. think that all of those things are super important. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
So we close with just a few rapid fire questions. Okay. And I'll keep this brief. Okay. I normally have the help of my co-host, but here I go.
Okay.
Your favorite winter vegetable or fruit?
I know this is supposed to be rapid fire. We sell a Tahitian pomelo. Everyone knows pomelos, but this is a special variety. That's probably my favorite, like, winter citrus. And then vegetables, as we get more into, like, Brussels sprouts and cauliflower, I love cauliflower. And I think, like, the cauliflower steak trend. Like, I had cauliflower steak last night for dinner.
Oh,
so, yeah. Wow. So we sell purple and orange cauliflower. So that's probably one of my favorites.
Oh, my gosh. That sounds so beautiful and exciting.
Yeah. Our website has a great recipe for, like, a whole roasted head of cauliflower with a salsa verde on it. It's so good. We made it for Thanksgiving. It was really good.
Oh, yum. Yeah. Okay. And last question. Any recent food trends that you despise?
That I despise.
And they can be, like, really social media driven. It can be anything.
I mean, I think this whole unicorn stuff, it's, like, all processed, like, sweet. Like, it gives me a headache looking at it. Because thinking of consuming something that's, like, blue and pink and purple with, like, sprinkles and glitter, like, so much sugar gives me a headache. I think that's kind of annoying. Like, let's be done.
Like, no, that's a great answer. And I love how you said, like, we can actually find that stuff naturally.
Exactly.
Whether it's a purple cauliflauer or mm-hmm. an orange I don't know if I've even seen orange cauliflower.
Yeah.
But I have seen you guys' red dragon fruits, mm-hmm. which are, like, oh my gosh, the color, it's stunning. And
yeah.
it's crazy to think that, like, we have these colors in nature.
Mm-hmm.
But There was actually a really cool documentary that kind of followed your family's business. Can you tell us a little bit about where people can find that and then where they can find you if they want to follow you and your business?
So the documentary was made about 5 years ago, and it's called Fear No Fruit. And it's obviously, you can figure out, you know, what it's about in the title. But it covers, you know, the story of my grandmother and her starting a business in the 60s as a woman in fresh produce, and then follows our company as well as the industry and what we face today. If you go on our website, there's a link there. It's available on YouTube for free. We just bought the rights back because we just want everyone to be able to get it. So if you Google Fear No Fruit, it's the first thing that'll pop up. And then you can follow Frida's on Instagram and Facebook at Frida's Produce. It's F-R-I-E-D-A-S, very important. And then you can follow me on Instagram. My handle is Ajax, A-J-A-A-A-C-K-S.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Alex. And you can follow us on Instagram or Facebook at Why Food Podcast. And you can follow me, your host, Valerie Lomas, on Instagram at Foodie in New York, or you can find me on my blog, foodieinnewyork.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you guys next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.